Today on Against the Grain, in 2013, Edward Snowden's revelations of mass surveillance by the National Security Agency pointed to spying on a mind-bending scale. Snowden drew denunciations and accolades from those around the world concerned about the U.S. national security state. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with journalist Prothap Chatterjee about the connection between that mass data collection and drone warfare, and about the state of surveillance and drone attacks 5 years on. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Prothap Chatterjee, Executive Director of CorpWatch, has been tracking the involvement of private companies in the U.S. military for decades. His book VIRAX, The True History of Whistleblowers, Drone Warfare, and Mass Surveillance, published by Metropolitan Books, which Chatterjee wrote with KPFA's Halil Bendib, tells the story of his efforts to connect the dots between NSA spying and the killings of civilians by U.S. unmanned aircraft in Pakistan, Yemen, and other countries. But it does so in an unusual way, in graphic novel form. Today I'm joined by him to discuss what we now know about the state of surveillance and drone warfare. Prothap, long before Edward Snowden's revelations about mass surveillance came out, you had been working on the shadowy world of spy agencies and other parts of the military-industrial complex, and the role of private contractors in warfare. Looking back now, how important was the U.S. response to the September 11th attacks in shaping what was to come later?
Well, the United States really felt it had been caught flat-footed after 9/11. That there was all this information that could possibly have been gathered. And in fact, there was some evidence that the information around the 9/11 hijackers was available to intelligence agencies and had never really been utilized or analyzed. So in the last 17 years, there has been many billions of dollars spent on trying to figure out how to prevent a repeat of that, to make sure that all the information that is possible to gather is gathered and analyzed. Now, unfortunately, since 9/11, our use of data has exponentially increased. So the amount of data the U.S. is gathering it's like a tsunami. And it's not just one tsunami; it just keeps coming. So there's a huge amount of data being generated by us, by businesses, by government, and the forms in which this way this data is transmitted also change by the month, by the year. You have new apps, things like Signal and Facebook Messenger. And so the government is trying its best to ensure that it captures all that data and then digs through it. Now, the problem is, of course, digging through actually voluminous amounts of actually terrible, inconsequential, often disconnected pieces of data and making sense out of it. And that's actually very, very hard.
Right. And in trying to think about the trajectory of what has happened, so after September 11th, there was the Iraq invasion, and there was the broadening of the number of private companies that were involved in a military-industrial complex, which already was very much populated by these public-private partnerships.
The military-industrial complex can be said to live, largely in the, not largely, but a big chunk of it is in Northern Virginia, right? And if you fly into Dulles Airport, when you leave the airport, you see the signs of all these companies, Lockheed and BAE and all these other companies, and they have traditionally made a lot of hardware and some software. So they built bombs, they built planes, etc. But what we really saw after 9/11 was an explosion in these sort of information technology companies. And this is, some of them are brand new, many of them. I mean, they're literally hundreds, thousands, easily tens of thousands of new companies that have grown out of, this desire for information, this desire for new technology. So these companies are making a fortune. I mean, the Pentagon's budget is, you know, of the order of $500 billion a year. And a huge amount goes to technology. Of course, the government is also buying food and boots and things like that. But a huge amount is spent on new technology, and these companies profit because essentially there's not really a lot of competition. A lot of it is not necessarily does a lot of stuff, particularly in the world of intelligence, takes place behind closed doors. There's a black budget, and then that black budget is spent between people in the know, who are typically people who used to work for the government. There's a revolving door here, no great surprise, and that's who profits out of it. And they produce technology that actually, and this is kind of the point of my writing, doesn't work. It doesn't produce any great information that can spot quote-unquote terrorists, or really much at all.
How do we understand just what you're describing about the mushrooming of private companies, especially focused on data collection or working around data, with the larger mushrooming of private companies doing the same that are not necessarily hooked into the military? Are these on parallel tracks, or is there some interaction? Because obviously from the 90s on, this exploded.
Sure. I mean, I mentioned, of course, the military manufacturers, hardware manufacturers like Lockheed and BAE and what have you. But of course, they're not the only people in this in this field. They have a big chunk of it. The telecom providers are a big part of it. So these are not necessarily people you'd think of as military contractors, but they always have been. This is not necessarily new at all, right? I mean, from the beginning of the creation of primitive telecommunications, the government has always worked, you know, in tapping the telegraph wires, and then the undersea telephone cables, now, you know, Wi-Fi systems, etc. So what we think of as sort of private industry, the people who provide our phone systems and our internet, they work very closely with government. The government has always maintained a relationship with these companies. They've bought, of course, services from them. They've also provided seed funding. The CIA has an investment arm. This is not actually secret. It's called InQtel in Palo Alto. And they provide money to create new technologies and figure out new ways of using this stuff. And I will say there's a caveat. I was at a few years ago, I was at Stanford, and I heard the head of the NSA saying, you know, you think we collect a lot? Do you have any idea how much Google and Facebook and Amazon collect? You know, it pales into insignificance. And he's not wrong. The private industry, separate from its collaboration with the U.S. government, is gathering data for us all the time, as we're discovering today, sure. You know, with the revelations of Facebook and the data that was gathered on voters and citizens and what have you. So this is big business, right? And it has... There's an interesting theory. I think there's an Israeli writer who's written about this, that we know the internet was created by the military. That is not necessarily a secret. And in fact, the reason the internet was created was so that they would have a communication system in the case of a major attack. It was distributed. Now, there's a theory, I don't know much about it, but that it was actually not simply created to provide information distribution, but also to keep an eye on dissidents. So, in fact, what we think of is this great democratic force, the internet, where, you know, anybody can speak up, anybody can be heard, you can organize instantly around the world. In fact, supposedly was conceived of a way, and I don't want to get into any kind of conspiracy theory in that sense, but the government has always found it useful to have a communication system that has some control of. Now, in a lot of countries, telecommunication systems are controlled by the government. That has never been true in the U.S. However, there has always been a very close relationship between the two. So that's a big part of industry. And now, of course, there's all the apps in Silicon Valley. All of these people, you know, from Angry Birds, you know, to Google, they have relationships with the military. I mean, they send data to the military.
Indeed, there's right now a controversy of Google employees taking a stand against something called Project Maven, a Pentagon joint venture with Google to use artificial intelligence for video imaging, which people fear might be used for drone strikes.
Well, I mean, it has been. I mean, in fact, CorpWatch, where I work, recently published a report that I am co-author of called Drone Inc. And in it, we look at all the technology in drones. We look at not really the companies that build drones, because drones themselves are just, you know, planes that can be remotely controlled. But the technology on board the drone, the video cameras, the listening devices, the cell phone tracking devices, the people that operate it, the technology they use, most importantly, the algorithms that they use to try and get information out of this. Because at the end of the day, having all the data is actually kind of useless. There's just so much data. What matters is trying to make sense out of it. Now, there are several factors that actually make it very difficult to make any sense out of it. First and foremost being the operators of this technology, the drones themselves, typically are kids straight out of high school. And my book, Virax, is really about whistleblowers, and in particular military whistleblowers, Air Force whistleblowers, and I interview a bunch of them in the book, and perhaps around nine. I'm not sure if all of them are in the book, but many of them are. And typically they've come to the military where they operate these drones, they track people's cell phones, they look at people through video cameras from halfway across the world. But really, they've just gotten out of high school. They've typically come from rural America. They've not traveled overseas. They very rarely speak Dari or Pashto or Arabic. So they are the people who operate this technology. They point the cameras. They gather the data. They analyze the data. So one of the biggest flaws is actually not really even the technology, but the fact that the people who are looking at this are typically pretty young with no real experience, and they are required to make life and death judgments. And this is, I think, for many of them, this once they realize their role in this, it becomes actually a huge burden. Especially if they're involved in combat, even from here, from California, where we have bases, or Nevada or New Mexico, they too suffer from what's called PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, because of the fact that they have actually been involved directly in selecting and eliminating, killing people. So this has an impact. Even if you didn't pull a gun or you didn't stab somebody, you know that you have participated in the act of killing, and you know that there is a very great chance that you made a mistake, and that the consequences for the family or the civilians that are targeted by drones is dramatic, and in fact may even create blowback. So there's a real problem, and I think soldiers themselves are very aware of this, despite their youth and their lack of knowledge of the countries they're bombing.
Well, and that speaks to one of the themes that runs through Virax, which is that although a lot of us in the United States are alarmed by the mass collection of data on us, that we often miss the connection to the gathering of data and targeted assassinations in other countries, which invariably involve more than just the purported target. And you talk about that a big factor in this is the desire by the U.S. military to fight wars remotely, fight wars without sending in troops, although obviously that has happened in the last two decades. But still, there's a desire to limit that as much as possible and have the U.S. exercise its military might with fewer consequences domestically, although increased consequences elsewhere. When did that push happen in the U.S. military? And when did it start intersecting with the availability of all of this data collected through mass surveillance?
Well, I mean, it's funny you raise that question. It is a theme that I have explored in my previous writing. My book before Virax was Halliburton's Army, and the book before that was Iraq Inc. And it looked at the whole-scale privatization of the U.S. military. And the reason for that was also to get soldiers out of the trenches, out of, you know, to reduce the number of Americans that were overseas who might be targeted. So really, when did this begin? Well, soon after the Vietnam War is really when the U.S. was in Vietnam, is that so many body bags came back. People were so upset because of the draft. It became politically unacceptable to participate in major wars. And so post 9/11, when the Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney and George Bush were planning, you know, the invasion of Afghanistan and the invasion of Iraq, they looked to figure out a way to do this without sending too many troops. So now that, of course, we could get into that in some more detail, but clearly, you know, that still involved putting people on foreign soil and risking their lives. So with the advent of the technology that made it possible to fight the war without going there, this was, you know, taken up by Obama, who also was elected on a platform in which he had said he would bring soldiers back home.
Indeed.
It made it possible. But it would be wrong to assume, much as I would like to blame George Bush for the war, or Barack Obama for the war on terror, Barack Obama for the drone war, to see this as purely driven by these individual presidents or these their political ideologies. This is really the arc of military logistics. It's the arc of technological progress. And in my previous book, Halliburton's Army, a lot of people in hearing about the book or learning about Halliburton just assumed this is about how the Republican Party, you know, was super evil and they did things the Democrats would not have done. But the book actually opens up with Donald Rumsfeld condemning the Democratic Party in the U.S. war in Vietnam when they used Brown and Root, later part of Halliburton, to support military logistics in the field. This is not something that is partisan. And had the places been switched and the Democrats had been in power right after 9/11, and let's say the Republicans had been in power instead of Obama, it is likely that they would still have privatized the military. They would have still sought ways to keep soldiers out of the field, and they would have used the power of remote warfare, the near instant quality of our communications. That is not really, you know, it's interesting because people say under Trump things must be so much worse. Well, they're not that different from under Obama. They're about the same. And even if you said that Trump is killing twice as many people as Obama, well, Obama killed 10 times as many people as George Bush did. So it is really sort of a trajectory. It has plateaued somewhat because of the lack of availability of sufficient personnel to actually operate these machines. So had Trump wanted to expand it as much as Obama did, it's actually not possible. So he is stymied by the lack of trained troops and technology.
That's Pratap Chatterjee, co-author of Virex, The True History of Whistleblowers, Drone Warfare, and Mass Surveillance. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you're making the point that there's a long history leading up to the point that you started in the book Virex, which jumps off in 2011 when WikiLeaks handed over to you and a number of other journalists the so-called spy files. What did you end up with, and what did those fragments, where did it send you?
Sure. In 2011, I was living in London. I was working for a nonprofit group called the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. And I had known Julian Assange and WikiLeaks for a little while, and he proposed working together with a lot of other groups, including the Washington Post and groups in France and Germany, etc., on this data trove that they had just uncovered or had been given, which was data on the companies that listened to our phone calls and provide the technology to be able to intercept and analyze this information. Now, I was aware of this. This isn't necessarily news. Those of us that follow the subject are aware that companies have been doing this for a long time. I was not really aware of the scale of it. So I have to say I was taken a little by surprise. I went to and this is depicted in the book. I visited a technology fair where these companies were selling this technology to police agencies, intelligence agencies, the military. And I had no idea how much of our technology, this is years before Snowden, 2-3 years before Snowden came out with his revelations. And so I was kind of horrified that everything we did could be tracked. That's not to say all that data could be gathered. That's not to say that they know everything that's happening, but they have access to all that data and how easy it was to hack into this kind of information. And in many ways, Julian Assange and WikiLeaks were sort of pioneers in explaining to journalists how to protect themselves. Until then, very few journalists, turned on, encrypted software, etc. And WikiLeaks was like, you got to be careful. This stuff is being, your information can be tracked. You need to be able to protect your sources, the whistleblowers, etc. And very few people understood that until then. And even though there's been a lot of criticism of all the work that WikiLeaks has done, they brought together journalists from around the world, and I was part of several of those projects in Afghanistan, Iraq, then the spy files, in which they brought, typically before that, journalists had worked, maybe a television station and a newspaper teamed up together. Maybe there were three or four. But WikiLeaks brought dozens, even hundreds of journalists together to collaborate and work together, which is really kind of an impressive undertaking. And the book opens with us looking at these files and looking at, in this particular instance, companies that were mostly working on providing technologies to repressive regimes in the Middle East, to Syria, to Egypt, to Libya. We didn't really look so much at the companies in the United States that did that. But it was clear to all of us that these technologies were available and used by the U.S. government also. And what we learned later, and the book opens with me also meeting with Laura Poitras, who's one of our collaborators there, who says you think this is bad what they're doing in Libya and Egypt? You should see what the National Security Agency is capable of. And I knew who they were, but I didn't really understand the details of it. And it was only when Edward Snowden came along, produced all these documents, that we realized how much industry had collaborated with government, how much information was being sucked up for the purposes. And this is another question that you just raised. I think a lot of people are upset about this because they feel like their information is being taken and they're being tracked. And I would say that I hate to sort of side a little with the military. The military isn't really interested in, what we had for lunch today or where we're going. What they're interested in is actually trying to figure out, who might be blowing up a bomb or some such thing. But in order to get that information, they need everybody's information.
Sure, although there is some revelations around radicals being tracked as well.
Absolutely. And the government has always done that. The government has always tracked, animal rights activists. They have always, that data is useful I'm not sure that they're tracking everybody, but in order to be able to track a few people, they have to have the data of everybody. So that's available for abuse. So in not stopping that, Barack Obama, made a grave mistake because he essentially handed over all our data to Donald Trump, right? Now, whether you like Donald Trump or not, the fact that this information can be now utilized by anybody who has access the system is worrisome, whether it's Obama or it's Trump.
Right. I think both would worry me. And you talk in Virax about the different components to that surveillance. There's the tracking, there's the hacking. So obviously, if they're particular targets, then people within the national security state could say, Pratap Chatterjee, he's a journalist, we want to focus on him particularly, see who he's talking to, is he in touch with whistleblowers? So that's a bit different than just throwing out a big net and grabbing a lot of data. But then, of course, there is that component of throwing out this net and ending up with mountains and mountains of data. And then the crucial question is, what do you do with it? So what's the role of analysis in this story?
So this is where it gets very sort of esoteric and fuzzy, because with all that data, and it is almost, you know, inconceivable how much data there is. I mean, so much so that even the NSA with their giant new storage center in Utah that, you know, could hold more data than anybody could ever dream of, they can still only hold 3 days worth of data. You know, it is virtually impossible. So you need to start to figure out ways to simplify that data. And so this is where algorithms come in. So the quote-unquote analysis is really using mathematics to break apart this information and to construct, you know, possible to find threads, shall we say, and to be able to lead to potential, you know, suspects or what have you. So, but it is. So the way we explain it, I interviewed this mathematician in Britain at the University of York, who said, you know, essentially what we have to do is we have to reduce people to vectors. You know, we have to reduce them to a number and a direction, and then we have to construct more complicated vectors and use those vectors to be able to figure out, you know, where these people are going. And this is, let's say, in the case of, let's say, a drone camera, where you have a video camera, you want to see where this person is going and see who they interact with. But you can extrapolate that idea to our phone calls, right? You have a phone call, and the phone call goes from A to B, and that is useful, but only if you get a lot of phone calls and you establish patterns. So now, once you spot those patterns, you need to figure out whether this is a valid pattern or not. And that's where it actually gets really complicated. The FBI has this term, they call it Pizza Hut cases. And the idea is that it's probably less true these days. Maybe you'd call it the Deliveroo or the, what are the companies that deliver food? Caviar or some such app. Is that back at least 20 years ago, the people that got the most phone calls in the United States were people doing takeout, right? So, if you were to look at and whether you're a terrorist or a government employee or anybody, you bought food and you called the same places. So what happened was the government started to realize that just by the system of trying to create patterns of finding where everybody was calling, what the center was, they were actually having a lot of these sort of false positives and false negatives, where they were actually finding people who actually had nothing to do with it. Now, you would think that they would have gotten a lot smarter about this, but it is actually very difficult to get beyond that, because the problem with having data is that you are restricted to that data, right? And so even though you have everybody's telephone calls, you don't know what happens outside those telephone calls. You don't know what happens when people meet in person. So you then narrow as opposed to enlarge. I mean, we think of this net as being, you know, all-encompassing. Actually, it's not. Because if I was planning, you know, a bomb or some such thing, last thing I would do is telephone somebody with it, right? I would try and stay off the telephone, right? If I was trying to attack somebody, I would not do it when I could see a drone or hear a drone above me, and you can see and hear them. So there is a simple way to not to be tracked. So what happens is the government is generally left with a lot of bad information, right? And so they're trying to cobble together a plausible scenario by which they can make find quote-unquote terrorists. So what they revert to is something that they've always done for a long time. And that was explored actually really well in a book called The Terror Factory. It's a book looking at every person that the FBI has arrested since 9/11, every Muslim that they've arrested and put behind bars. And what they discovered was the government was actually planting weaponry or fake weaponry on these people. And then as soon as they agreed to move forward with the plot, they were arresting them. And The U.S. government has very rarely, when you read about these cases, you think, well, of course, that was a bad guy and they caught him. And he was, you know, he was intercepted before, you know, he had time to do anything bigger. But once, as Trevor Aaron is the name of the writer of Terror Factory did, once you add up all the cases, you realize what the government is doing is taking the data they have and trying to make a case out of it and trying to add, you know, its own theories to it, because actually that data is relatively useless. And this is one of the biggest problems with relying on technology to provide justice. I mean, if it was possible to spot, a murderer using technology, you know, we would be able to prevent crime and robberies in the United States, and we can't. I mean, but really what we're doing, and this is the analogy I think that is probably the best, is imagine that there was a serial killer on the streets of Berkeley, and you wanted to figure out who that person was. Well, the best way you can figure that out is going and interviewing neighbors and, having people, write down information, sit down, analyze it, and come up with theories on the ground. But what if you were to hire a group of people in Inner Mongolia, aged 18, who spoke no English, and ask them to figure out who the perpetrator of this, the serial killer was in Berkeley? I mean, you would have no chance whatsoever. But that is actually what we're doing. So we think we have a lot of information. I mean, these kids in Inner Mongolia, let's say they have access to all of our telephone calls and they can watch from the sky, they still would not be able to figure out what was happening because it would be impossible. But that is exactly what we're trying to do. So the very fact that you have information, I think it is, we think of information as cure for everything and technology. We think of technology as a cure for everything, but it isn't. It actually makes us think we have knowledge that we don't really have.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with the co-author of Virax, The True History of Whistleblowers, Drone Warfare, and Mass Surveillance. That's published by Metropolitan Books, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Pratap Chatterjee, who wrote the book along with Halil Bendib, is executive director of CorpWatch. In Virax, you make the case, and you've just made the case, that the technology that the U.S. spends billions of dollars on, the surveillance, the drones, actually add up to a very inaccurate picture of what's going on. And that actually seems fairly obvious, right? That having people on the other side of the world trying to make sense of what they're seeing in a foreign country on grainy video footage added together with some surveillance of people's cell phone calls, that the chances are that that is going to be a pretty ineffective way of finding out what's going on. Which raises the question, does the military actually care? I mean, is there a logic to this that propels it along? Given how obviously faulty this is going to be, why would they pursue it?
I mean, I think the simple answer, there's one word, it's politicians, right? The military is actually aware of how bad the data is. They know that this is not the way to win a war. A number of generals in the report Drone Inc., at the end of the report that we produced for CorpWatch.
And I should say we have a link to that on our website, againstthegrain.org.
Well, thank you. And in that, I cite a general from the Army, a general from the Air Force, and a general from the Navy, each of whom say, we know the system doesn't work. But, I mean, in the absence of the political will to send soldiers overseas, in the presence of a political desire to be seen as tough on terrorism, they're making the best of a bad job. The politicians say, you need to go and fight a war in Syria, right? And we will give you the money and we'll give you the technology. Just don't get any Americans killed and come back and prove to everybody that you've been effective. So the military goes off and drops bombs and fights wars. I'm not saying that they don't believe in the mission. I think they do. But I think they are also quite aware of how inaccurate it is. And it is quite frustrating. I know somebody who was in the National Security Council. I won't say any more than that. For many years, for 10 years. And this person said that when the politicians, this member of the National Security Council, who went to 500 deputies meetings and worked with Obama on a lot of these things, said the politicians, like Obama, would come and say, we need to do this. You know, send the drones here and do that. And the soldiers, the generals would say, well, we can't do that. It is actually not possible. Our equipment cannot get you the information you want. It cannot win this war or bring you back, you know, the kind of results you desire. But they kind of had no choice, right? It was their government to obey, their duty to obey the politicians. And the politicians, you know, had to prove to the public that they were doing what they were doing. So it is almost a, you know, it's just a catch-22.
It's interesting, Anna. Certainly the idea that politics is driving it makes sense, but it's not that the public is clamoring for drone strikes. And in fact, these efforts are supposed to be secret, or, you know, they won't either acknowledge it or deny it and so on. And so it's interesting why the motivation then by politicians to do these attacks is there. Is it about a notion of projecting American power beyond the U.S. public?
Absolutely. It is about projecting American power. It is about the U.S. Sees itself, and this is true of Trump, Obama, Bush, Jimmy Carter, all of these presidents and all of Washington, D.C. sees itself as a superpower in charge of the world, right? And that, and of course, many people believe, many of them say this is a benevolent force for peace, etc. We know that's not true. But they will not deny, I think, the fact that they see the projection of U.S. military might as being a way to be able to ensure that markets are open, that that business comes their way, that politics is done in the best interest of the United States. And the best interest of the United States is not the interest of every individual, but the best interests of the quote-unquote economy and therefore business. So at the end of the day, I mean, I don't believe, there's a lot of listeners who would probably disagree with me in saying that, of course, the war on terror is a war about oil, and Bush simply did it, you know, to enrich his friends at Exxon or Shell or whatever. I'm not sure that I would go that far. I would say that there is a group of people, you know, who are friends with each other, and they are executives of big companies, and they are generals, and they are politicians, and so they do what's good for themselves. So you go out with your friends and let's say go to a certain restaurant or go for a certain game or see a certain movie. These guys do things together because they have always controlled the world. The meritocrats, the elites. And this includes the liberals too. This is not just, sure, you know, the Republicans and the and Donald Trump.
Indeed, Hillary Clinton, were she president right now,
would be doing exactly the same thing. Hillary Clinton's war would not be any different from Donald Trump's war at all. So the U.S. does business. I mean, it is sort of interesting to see, you know, Bill Clinton, after he left power, you know, goes in, and Hillary Clinton, they give speeches to bankers and to, you know, we condemn rightly Donald Trump for his business dealings with Russia. Well, Bill Clinton had similar dealings, you know. Hillary Clinton was opening up, you know, helping support natural gas exploration throughout the former Soviet Union. Bill Clinton was taking money from Russian banks and things like that. There is a world of wealthy people. I mean, Bill Clinton and Donald Trump's families have been friends for decades. This is not necessarily, Barack Obama might be new to that world, but now he is, you know, very much part of it. You know, he holidays with Richard Branson. He travels the world, does the same thing. So for these people, it's business as usual.
And it's pretty transparent. I mean, not that things don't go on behind closed doors, but most of this actually doesn't. I'm not talking about the things with the national security state, but the larger project that you're talking about here, right, of the business class in the United States and its imperial stance. A lot of that is very transparent. It's just about the exercise of power.
Absolutely. I mean, Donald Trump may have Peter Thiel advising him, but, you know,
the PayPal.
From PayPal. But Barack Obama had Jeffrey Immelt, CEO of General Electric. And really, Is there that much of a difference between PayPal and General Electric? No, they're big business. I mean, that's and it's their job to, you know, make as much money as they can. And if government will help them, they're all for it. If government stands in their way, well, they will stand up and protest, you know, against, you know, trade wars and things like that. So it is in their interest. I mean, war is in the interest of certain companies, you know, obviously the people who make this kind of hardware and software. It isn't necessarily the best thing for businesses, let's say, that are in the places that are being bombed. Like, I'm sure the oil industry is actually not really that happy about Iran and Iraq, because it actually hasn't
paid. Creates too much chaos.
It creates too much chaos, and it hasn't paid dividends for them, because to this day, U.S. companies are not benefiting out of Iraq, and they have not benefited of Iran for years. So they're not always in favor of this. But the U.S., I think, goes into these things not so naively, because they think that they, if they control, they will be able to deliver business. And I do believe that George Bush felt that he wasn't trying to create chaos. I mean, I'm sure that Naomi Klein would disagree with me there. But he was there because he thought he could stabilize the area and make it open for American business.
Sure, open up the markets. And I should say I'm speaking with journalist Prothap Chatterjee about his book, VIRAX, The True History of Whistleblowers, Drone Warfare, and Mass Surveillance. And I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So bringing things then to the present, you were saying that although people are fearful that under Trump, at least drone warfare will be worse than under Obama, and you're saying that there's much more continuity than rupture. It's now been 5 years since the revelations of Edward Snowden, and a lot has changed beyond Donald Trump replacing Barack Obama. We know now about data collection happening on a phenomenal scale in private businesses. Would you say that there are any sort of qualitative changes from then to now in terms of what we know? More of the same, maybe just enlarged? How do you see it?
Well, I think there's been a lot of positive change as a result of Edward Snowden. The first is Silicon Valley has realized that it's actually bad for their business to be obviously giving away all our data. Nowadays, a lot of companies have turned on encryption at the source. So Facebook Messenger, and this is not to support Facebook at all, has much better encryption than it did before. And that's because of Edward Snowden.
And you mean giving away our data to the U.S. government? You're not meaning collecting our data for their own purposes?
Oh, no, they're still collecting it for their own purposes. I should clarify, yeah. So it is now possible, and actually fairly common, you know, I know a librarian at UC Berkeley. I know a Japanese teacher who use Signal. These are not people who are, involved in visiting Iraq.
This is the encryption app.
Using Signal, which is an encryption app by which you can send messages that cannot be tracked, simply because Signal itself doesn't collect the data on its servers. So the only person who has access to the data is yourself and the recipient. Now, that, of course, doesn't prevent somebody from grabbing your phone and arresting you and reading your phone. But it still is a lot better than in the past, when information just leaked out and could be gathered by pretty much anyone. In fact, you know, hackers were able to intercept people's phone calls and messages, you know, for about a $50 device. And that is no longer true. So I will say that since Edward Snowden revealed the scale of surveillance and data interception, Silicon Valley has been much more cognizant about making sure that this data is encrypted. And a lot of people, I mean, I would say hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people now are much more careful about what they do. So that has been very, very good, I think. The government has made some, Congress has made some changes and restricted the kind of data that the intelligence agencies can gather. But there are always loopholes and there are always new agreements and technologies that can be used. So even though there have been some changes in Capitol Hill in terms of revising rules around FISA collection, which is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court. So that's what it is. So it is a court that allows the government to tap people's phones. So those rules have been tightened a little bit.
But hasn't there also been legislation passed that allows your internet service provider to hand all your data over?
See, this is part of the problem is that even though some advances have been made, there have been other things that have been done. And WikiLeaks actually recently published a trove of data from the CIA showing how the CIA was trying to figure out ways to get around encryption by getting to the root of the phone devices themselves. Because the thing is, as I noted, if I have access to your phone and I have, you know, and I can read your data right now, it makes it harder to intercept everybody's email and be able to read it all at once. But if you can get, if you can hack the actual root of the phone, you can have access to that data. So that is that it. There are new technologies created every day by which you can get access to that data. Does the government have access to all of that? Are there ways around that? You know, these are things that are actually kind of hard to answer. But I would say that because people have become more security conscious, more security options are available. Many more services have encrypted their information. I mean, it is for the big businesses in the United States, like Facebook, like Google, etc. The idea that European governments are starting to say you cannot take people's information, and if you do, we won't do business with you, is a problem for these very profitable companies. So it is still in their interest to let's say collaborate with the government in tracking certain individuals. It is probably not in their best interest to give all the data over. But as you pointed out, that doesn't mean they don't use it for their own purposes. That's how they make their money. And
probably creating profiles even more detailed than the NSA's mass grab.
Absolutely, yeah. So that problem has not gone away.
Let me end by asking you about what, if anything, has changed since Edward Snowden's revelations in 2013 regarding whistleblowers. Your book, Virax, talks about people who have come forward who were involved in drone strikes from the U.S. military side, who are willing to talk about what they did and how it all worked. After Snowden's revelations and the call for off with his head, and then, of course, the imprisonment and release of Chelsea Manning, do you think that the situation for whistleblowers has changed at all, and are people as willing to come forward as they were?
I think actually I would say that's a bright spot in our political landscape, and it's not, and it's partly because of Edward Snowden. It's also partly because of the election of Donald Trump. Is a lot more people in government agencies are willing to take risks now, and figure out ways to thwart the government from doing things that are wrong. So the book Virax actually ends in 2017. So it covers part of the Trump administration, but only the first few months. And so most of the whistleblowers that we talk to in our book are people who spoke out in the Obama era. I do know from my conversations with people in government that I don't think people, certainly government servants, and there are many millions of them, or a couple of million of them, have been cowed. I think, in fact, if anything else, they've been emboldened, and they realize that it is their job to go out and blow the whistle. And that's what this book is about. The book is really kind of a call to action. It's a celebration of these whistleblowers. Some say, you know, it's kind of a, it's a disturbing story of death and destruction, but it is also hopefully an empowerment story. And one of the things is I've written a lot of technical stuff about how the technology works and how it doesn't work. I know I've also written about the law, and there are lawyers who talk about this stuff. My feeling is that really things will change when young people in the military and civil servants, you know, read comic books. A plug for my for Virax again here, and decide that they need to delve deeper. And so that's kind of why we wrote the book and why I think things will change. I think there is hope, and you know, it's interesting in the year and a quarter that Trump has been president, he has actually not prosecuted whistleblowers in the way Obama prosecuted more whistleblowers than all the other presidents before him, and throw Trump in too, you know. So far there hasn't been, a lot of people have been fired, a lot of positions have been filled, but so far whistleblowers have not had as much intimidation as they did under Obama.
Prathap, it's been a pleasure having you on.
Thank you for having me, Sasha. Always a pleasure to be back.
I've been speaking with Prathap Chatterjee, co-author of Virax, The True History of Whistleblowers, Drone Warfare, and Mass Surveillance, published by Metropolitan Books. And I should say it's co-authored by Khalil Bendib. You can find a link to the book on our website, againstthegrain.org. And Prathap is executive director of CorpWatch. You can also find a link on our website to Drone Inc., which is a publication put out by CorpWatch. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.